from the nation's capital, this is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, the topic for today is technology and corrections, high priority needs. A really innovative, really interesting document that came out of the RAND Corporation. We have two people by our microphones today. We have Brian Jackson. Brian is director of the Safety and Justice Program and a senior physical scientist at RAND. His research focuses on technology issues in public safety, including both the use of technology in policing, corrections, and the courts, and technological use in crime by adversary groups, which I love to hear a little bit more about. Joe Russo is a researcher at the University of Denver focusing on technology issues in the corrections sector. He is currently in support of a number of initiatives for the National Law Enforcement and Corrections Technology Center, a program of the National Institute of Justice. And to Joe and to Brian, welcome to D.C. Public Safety.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right. Joe's been at our microphone several times before. Every time we do a show on technology, it turns out to be one of our most popular shows. I read this document, and I find it fascinating. Fostering innovation in community and institutional corrections, identifying high-priority technology and other needs in the U.S. corrections sector. And, you know, there's a variety of documents that comes out on technology or corrections or the criminal justice system. I find this to be a seminal document. I find this to be one of the most important documents I've seen within the correctional arena. Am I overplaying my hand here, Brian, or what?
Well, that's certainly what we're trying to do here. The goal of this project really is a very ambitious one to try to help catalyze innovation in the criminal justice community. And so certainly we hope that this document will be that important. But whether it actually is that important will depend on a lot of other actors in the correction center to take the ideas that came up in this study and put them into practice.
What it does is takes virtually every issue that we have in both community corrections and mainstream corrections, analyzes it, prioritizes, makes it a priority or puts it in rank order, and figures out whether or not there is technology that could have an impact on those particular issues. I mean, all the problems that we have today could have a technological solution if they do, you list them and put them in rank order. In the ballpark?
That's certainly what we did. We did it in collaboration with a lot of practitioners from the community to take advantage of their expertise and their on the ground knowledge, and with their help, tried to rank them to identify sort of where to start. There's always a lot of ways that improvements in technology or practice could sort of help organizations be more effective or more efficient, and the challenge is always to figure out where to start. And so in this effort, we not only tried to be comprehensive and look at a lot of the challenges facing corrections, a lot of the potential solutions, but then try to winnow them down to the ones that really looked best to practitioners in the area.
Joe, how did the University of Denver that supports JustNet, which is an organization funded by the National Institute of Justice of the U.S. Department of Justice, how did the University of Denver get involved in this project?
Well, we're partners with RAND on a larger NIJ-funded effort to identify high-priority needs across the criminal justice sector. And our role in support of RAND is specific to the corrections community. So we assisted with developing this report, assembling the advisory panel, and so on.
And Joe's been by our microphones 1,000 times, again, producing some of our most popular programs in terms of talking about technology and corrections, technology in the criminal justice system. Okay, gentlemen. Now that we've introduced the document, oh, and by the way, the document is going to be in the show notes, the address for the document, but on the website, www.rand.org, www.rand.org. Oh, before going further into the show, Brian, for the uninitiated, what is RAND?
Oh, well, certainly. RAND is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research organization. We do research for a wide variety of clients, a lot of them in government, federal agencies, state and local government, but also the private sector. And our mission is to improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. So we're a lot of academic researchers, but we're academic researchers that really judge our success by whether what we do sort of makes things better in the real world.
And for the practitioner community, I've been following RAND since the beginning of my academic career. RAND has put out some of the most famous and well-known studies involved in the criminal justice system. I remember decades ago reading your research on habitual offenders and found it fascinating, and that prompted a discussion throughout the criminal justice system. Joe, how do people use this document? How do policymakers, how do practitioners use this document?
Well, as you mentioned, it's sort of a seminal document and foundational in a lot of ways. And part of our approach was to establish the state of the art. So we took a look across the spectrum of what corrections is, what it has been, and identified, you know, the different technologies and different policies and practice that are currently in place. And then from there, as we alluded to, we identified emerging or current needs and tried to develop associated problems or ways to address those problems. How the various groups can use this information is diverse depending on the audience. Private industry can use this information because it's a very valuable source of needs from the horse's mouth, so to speak, from the end users themselves who have articulated what their needs are. So private industry who's interested in making an investment in the sector kind of has a blueprint that identifies, at least a starting point, what the needs of the community are. From the federal perspective, funding sources, again, have that ready-made source of previously identified high-priority areas so they can target their research and development portfolios accordingly.
All right. Either one of you can come in and answer this question. There are 7 million people under the adult correctional system, the supervision of the adult correctional system every single day. 7 million people. 700,000 people come out of prisons on a year-to-year basis. That does not include the numbers in terms of the juvenile justice system. That does not include people coming out of the jail system. So there are enormous numbers of people. We in the criminal justice system, I've heard from my peers throughout the country that they are overwhelmed by the numbers, overwhelmed by the complexity, overwhelmed by the problems. So what we're talking about is, I don't know, how many problems do we want to look at? Mental health. So if I said mental health from a technology point of view, what would the response of the document be?
Well, I mean, I can jump in on that. I mean, certainly those were two of the really big challenges that the practitioners that we worked with here talked about, sort of simply the ideas of scale and also the challenges of mental health issues in prisoner populations that the correctional system is having to deal with today. I mean, when you look at the sort of the options that were talked about in the document, they ranged from sort of low-tech sort of approaches, you know, better training to help deal with mental health issues, all the way up to sort of high technology activities, you know, sort of better sensors or systems to try to prevent suicide attempts in institutional settings, or in the case of the large supervision burden for individuals who are in the community correction system. Better technologies to do individual tracking and make that a more effective element of sort of correctional supervision and dealing with offenders in that context. And so really that's what for me at least was one of the most sort of interesting responses or interesting findings that came out of this work is that these very large problems can have multiple solutions to them, some of which may be technological systems, but some of them may be, more about policies and practice, how we do things. And so the opportunities there to match solutions to the needs of different correctional systems and so on is an opportunity to make broader change across the sector as a whole.
Right. And there are going to be practitioners throughout the country listening to this program today thank God. this is so needed because the discussion throughout the country today is talking about less use on prisons, less reliance on mainstream incarceration, and a greater reliance on community supervision. And community supervision is sitting there going, oh my heavens, there's no way we can take on more people. I mean, it would have to be a technological solution because the money isn't there. I mean, the average caseload right now, I don't think there is a national average, but I think it comes close to 150 to one parole and probation agent. I have seen cases where it's 250, 300 cases for one parole and probation agent. Here in the my agency, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency in Washington, D.C., we are so lucky. We have under 50 to 1 ratios. But we're unusual, and we're lucky because we're a federal agency. But for everybody else, they're overwhelmed. They're saying, if you can't give me a technological solution to handling this huge caseload and to provide the services and the supervision concurrently, if you can't provide me a tech solution, we can't do this. Are they right?
I'll jump in. I think they're exactly right, and it's interesting that this issue was brought up by both parts of the panel. The institutional corrections side brought up the issue that a lot of the prison realignment strategies, particularly in California, have created a burden on the local jails. And so they identify the need for more alternatives to incarceration to get folks out of the jails. Well, at the same time, in a nearby room, the community corrections folks were gathering, and they said, well, you know what? We're getting all of these highly violent folks who we typically would not previously get, but due to realignment efforts across the board, now they're being pushed into the community. And so we have a situation now known as mass supervision versus mass incarceration, mm-hmm. which gets to exactly what you're speaking about. We don't have the resources, we don't have the tools to deal with this ever-growing population. And so what the community corrections folks said is the need was more targeted resources specifically for community corrections so they can meet this challenge. So it's kind of interesting how the both groups identified similar problems coming from different approaches.
But what would be the technological solution? What immediately comes to my mind would be global positioning or satellite supervision of individuals, GPS supervision of individual offenders. But as effective as that may be, that puts a brand new set of requirements and a brand new workload onto the shoulders of parole and probation agents. So in some cases, technology is a plus, and in some cases, it is not nearly as good as people make it out to be. I'm not questioning the effectiveness of GPS. I'm simply saying that instead of talking to this person once a week, now they're getting data points, hundreds of them every single day, and they're saying that they can't process all that information.
Well, figuring out ways to improve sort of technologies that exist now was a big element of what we covered in the advisory panel discussions. And so in that case, sort of one of the things that was discussed was, better analysis tools where, reviewing those hundreds of data points didn't produce, hundreds of false alarms that were bouncing into the inbox of, all of these supervision officers.
Right.
But analytics that helped filter that data stream to make it possible to focus on the truly important elements of that. But other pieces of sort of technology in terms of trying to deal with volume and deal with distance that came up were ideas like, the ability to deliver programming at a distance, whether that's, sort of using a technology like Skype to allow people to, more efficiently meet with, the people that they were supervising, or in the case of treatment provision, the people that they were treating as part of their supervision, and, have better understandings and evaluations of the effectiveness of those alternative models of delivery that could help, remove some of the, travel burdens, if you will, in a jurisdiction where officers have to travel over long distances to visit their supervisees in person.
So to deal with individuals on supervision through video visitation, either through, my app on my iPhone and my iPad gives me the right to instantaneously communicate with my wife through her iPhone or iPad. So technologies along those lines to deliver services to individuals, to ask them questions or to supervise them, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. But the challenge is understanding whether that's as effective as the traditional ways of doing that. Sort of emphasizing that in order to enable innovation, we both need the good technology ideas and also need the evaluation, so we have confidence going in that sort of the new ways of doing things will work well.
Right. But people are saying that, and I'm mixing radio shows here because I've done radio shows. I just did a show on video visitation. I've done a show on correctional education. People are saying that the overwhelming majority of individuals caught up in the criminal justice system do not get the services they need. If it's not done by video, if it's not done by distance learning, it's probably not going to be done at all. So I think people need to understand that out of everybody out there who has a substance abuse problem, when they come into parole and probation and when they come into mainstream corrections, the data that I'm looking at is that only a small minority of those individuals get substance abuse treatment or substance abuse education. So people are suggesting if it's not done by video, it's not going to get done.
And that's certainly, an approach that should be examined and exploited. That's what you're describing there is an efficiency issue. We can deliver the services better, more efficiently, more inexpensively, and so on. And certainly that needs to be examined. I think Brian is right. At the end of the day, we need to evaluate, is it truly better than nothing? And if so, how much better than nothing? I mean, these are things that shouldn't impede agencies exploring these technologies. But, researchers lagging will have to examine that and look at it and determine the effectiveness and whether it's worth the investment. But the larger issue, I think, when you talk about GPS and other technological tools to supervise offenders is, most technologies, other than the process-type technologies, most supervision-type technologies involve work. And that's a point that often people miss, is that, we just put folks on GPS and that makes it easier, more efficient. Well, that creates a lot of workload, and that needs to be examined from a larger context of risk assessment, which was a common theme in the Community Corrections Group as part of this panel. We need better tools to identify who needs what level of service and then targeted resources directed to those folks. And that gets to the larger issue is, is everyone within this criminal justice system need to be there? And the folks who are within the criminal justice system already, do they need the same level of resource? And obviously the answer is no, but we need better tools to differentiate who needs what type of intervention.
Gentlemen, I want to reintroduce both of you. Ladies and gentlemen, we're doing a show today on innovative use of corrections technology. Brian Jackson is the director of the Safety and Justice Program and a senior physical scientist at RAND. Joe Russo, back at our microphones, is a researcher at the University of Denver focusing on technological issues within the corrections sector. The document that we're talking about is Fostering Innovation in Community and Institutional Corrections, Identifying High Priority Technology and Other Needs in the U.S. Corrections Sector. I want to give out the websites for both gentlemen and the document for RAND, www.rand.org, and we'll have the direct URL or the address to get you to that document, but you can also find it by searching RAND's website or simply Googling it. Joe, and as at the University of Denver, www.justnet.org. Gentlemen, to enter into this new era of corrections, whether it be mainstream corrections in a prison or whether it be a parole and probation agent who usually comes with a bachelor's degree or higher, you're talking about a fairly technologically sophisticated individual who can handle multiple technological platforms at the same time to supervise his or her community supervision population or to run a safe and efficient prison system. We're talking about a level of technology that we do not have now, correct?
In some respects, the technology is already in place. The technology will grow and improve, and that's going to be continuous. But I think the point that you're getting at, Len, is that corrections is changing to a degree that there's a large we need some specialization. If you go into a prison, a newer prison these days, almost everything is wired. So the technical skills needed to operate a prison or to run facilities within a prison are much different than they were 20 years ago, and that's going to continue to change. more and more prisons are looking at allowing access to the internet for inmates as part of education reentry services. Almost every security system, you know, plugs in or is connected to a network in some way. So, and a lot of the same things are happening in community corrections, whether it's GPS or, social media monitoring, whatever the case might be. As society changes and becomes more technologically advanced, you know, the supervision services have to, you know, keep pace. And certainly the job is changing. On the positive side, you know, with new millennials and other generations coming into the workforce, they're more ready and adaptable to that type of approach.
But to ask that person, let's just say going back to community corrections, and I don't mean to keep harping on community corrections, but that's where I've spent the last 11 years with the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency here in downtown Washington. To be able to analyze that individual, figure out through some sort of algorithm as to whether or not this person is high risk, medium risk, or no risk, what that person's needs are, what they're not, figure out whether or not that person should be supervised at all or placed on the lowest level of supervision or the highest level of supervision, operate a GPS unit video interface with that person on a fairly regular basis. That requires a certain sophistication. That requires a certain wherewithal. And do we have that workforce now?
Well, I mean, I in all sectors, we sort of have that challenge as technology changes. Sort of me working in a research environment, I use very different technologies and sort of interface with my colleagues in a very different way than, what happened 20 years ago. And that creates training challenges. Some of that is solved by, you know, as Joe pointed out, sort of the millennials coming into the sector and bringing with them greater technological familiarity and sort of a comfort level simply because they've used a lot of technology similar to this. But in many of the areas in the discussions with our advisory panel as part of this work, you know, sort of the training implications of both technologies and how to use them and how to make decisions about acquiring them sort of came out as part of the discussion as a key element to, you know, thinking about innovation and corrections, where, you know, whether that is training up, you know, individual, practitioners to use the technologies effectively, or whether that's figuring out, you know, how to present information to leaders who are making decisions about technologies that they have to learn about as they're making the assessment and procurement decisions. And so a lot of this sort of falls into an area of, you know, how do we, you know, produce that information in a way where the sector can use it effectively, since, you know, if we want innovation, part of that is, you know, arming the people who are making the choices and who are using the technologies on a daily basis with what they need to use it effectively. You can't get good outcomes just by buying a new technology and assuming that it will happen, you know, work well. You know, there's an investment that needs to be made there to let it be sort of adopted effectively by the organization and its members.
Part of the document talks about the poor outcomes on key correctional measures of effectiveness, notably offender recidivism. Offender recidivism measured by, I can think of three historic documents and documents from other individuals and taking a look at individual research programs, is pretty daggone high in terms of recontact with the criminal justice system, rearrest. Generally, the mantra has been within 3 years, two-thirds rearrested and 50% reincarcerated. You take a look at other reports and you get variations on those figures. But in essence, the figures are high. How does technology have an impact, have a bearing on improving the effectiveness in terms of offender outcomes?
Well, I'll jump in. I think technology in the prison sector can be very useful and is already being applied to support reentry. I mentioned earlier about, you know, agencies being more open to internet access, if not complete, which is not on the table yet, but at least access to internet content to help offenders develop their, you know, vocational skills, education skills, make connections with potential employers and resources in the community. So between video visitation, video conferencing in general, giving offenders access to the community before they reach the community, I think technology can be leveraged to a great degree.
RAND, interestingly enough, did an overview correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty daggone sure it was Rand, I think I saw it yesterday, talking about correctional education. And part of that document, they suggested that the video delivery of services was as effective as in person. I may be overplaying my hand here, but it was pretty encouraging in terms of what you can do through video delivery. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, that was certainly part of that study done by a number of my colleagues here at RAND who were looking both at the effectiveness overall of educational interventions and the very significant effect and cost-effective effect that they have on reducing recidivism after release, but also this element of technology in delivering those educational interventions. And again, this comes down to resources where it may be more costly to deliver education in person and be able to deliver it at a distance, whether that's on a tablet-based system or a video-based system in a classroom, where the technology can become sort of the force multiplier to let these services to reach more inmates and as a result hopefully have a better effect for them as they leave to reintegrate into society and hopefully find other things to do that do not lead them back into the correctional system.
There are companies out there, and I guess I shouldn't mention the one company that I have in mind, but I'm confronted as a person in the criminal justice system who's been doing public affairs for the last 35 years. I'm always confronted with new technologies, and I'm always confronted with the need to learn. There's a company out there that provides technological overviews of equipment, of programs, of modalities that don't assume that you have any prior knowledge of that technology at all. And they walk you step by step, bit by bit, to the point where you feel pretty comfortable creating Final Cut Pro and creating a green screen movie in Final Cut Pro. This seems to be a powerful event in our lives in terms of the potential for delivering educational programs, vocational programs, maybe even mental health issues.
Absolutely. I mean, often we talk about telemedicine as a way to deliver medical services, but telepsychiatry is established as well as a way to make contact and get deliver services to inmates in prisons and even folks in the community. I mean, one of the things that came across during our research here was the needs of the rural agencies. And because of isolation, it's not an efficiency issue in terms of using video to connect with their clientele. It's a resource issue. There's no other way to effectively connect with their clientele other than video and other technology type approaches. So it's very important.
Final 3 minutes of the program. We have a criminal justice system that is emerging in the technological arena, but I don't get the sense that we're all that terribly sophisticated. And I don't get the sense that a lot of our agencies are run by people with tech backgrounds. How long will it take the criminal justice system to gear up, fund, train, implement a technological solution across the board for managing offenders both in the community or managing people behind prison bars?
Well, certainly innovation across the entire system is a high bar. I mean, in our criminal justice system, the fact that we do this in a decentralized way means that we have sort of a lot of independent actors that are making their own decisions that face their own financial constraints and their own sort of legacy systems constraints. And so if you're thinking about sort of innovation across the board in the same way, it'll be a long time. But the advantage that we have in that is that we have a lot of separate agencies that can do experiments and can try things and figure out what works. And that provides a sort of a benefit to the other agencies that would come after them. So on the one hand, thinking about uniform innovation, it'll be a long time. But what I'm encouraged by, particularly with the great ideas that came up in our advisory panel, is that we've got a lot of agencies out there that are trying new things, and their experience can sort of help lead the way for other agencies that come after.
Yeah, but I'm suggesting that there's a sense of, I don't want to use the word panic, but apprehension on the part of community corrections saying, we need this stuff now. If we're going to deinstitutionalize, rely more upon community supervision, and you're going to even increase the caseloads that we're dealing with now, you've got to give us tools. I think that what I'm hearing is a need for speed.
Well, there's no doubt that there's urgency, but it's a double-edged sword. You don't want to introduce technologies that haven't been, you know, validated in the field or that potentially create an increased workload like GPS systems.
Yes.
It's a balancing act. And as Brian said, there are agencies who are doing things sort of piecemeal. That's probably not the right term. But here and there, they're experimenting, and some are having very good results.
All right, Joe, you've got the final word. Ladies and gentlemen, we've had Brian Jackson, Director of Safety and Justice Programs for RAND, Joe Russo, a researcher at the University of Denver, today talking about an extraordinary document, Fostering Innovation in Community and Institutional Corrections. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very pleasant day.